The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Megan Abbott. Her new novel is You Will Know Me. She joins us by telephone from Los Angeles. Hello, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Much better now, Megan. I've been wanting to talk to you.
Oh, excellent. Well, likewise.
This new novel is a very gymnastic novel, and everybody's watching the Olympics right now, and I saw someone on Twitter the other day who was saying how they thought it was so sad to look at some of these gymnasts because their bodies just didn't seem right. And reading your new novel, that's a very predominant vibe throughout the book. Tell us how you got the idea for this.
Yes, that is one of the reasons. I mean, I always wanted, you know, it's essentially a book about a prodigy, a gymnastic prodigy, from the point of view of her parents. But I wanted to write about a prodigy, but I landed particularly on gymnastics because I was fascinated about its impact on young girls' bodies, which, you know, isn't always as rigorous and sort of, you know, in some ways transformative as it is for gymnasts at the Olympic level, but it certainly affects girls' development if they're doing it from a young age. It's sort of, you know, building them to be this sort of missile, which isn't, of course, the natural course of development as we would think of it. So that aspect of it seemed particularly compelling. Girls' bodies are always sort of a spectacle, but in this case, it's a really intense kind of spectacle. And I think we do see that when we see gymnasts on the certain international stage.
This is the story of a family. And it's the classic nuclear family. There's a man, a woman, and a daughter and a son. And yet there's something very twisted about this family. The daughter gets all the attention. And the son is this wonderful kid who just kind of puts up with it. Let's talk about this family.
Yes, and they are the sort of a classic core family. In many ways, the sort of all-American family. And that was sort of one of my interests about it. And I came from a family like that, you know, father, mother, sister, brother. But I was always really interested in siblings of sort of exceptional children, you know, because they're sort of in the shadow through their whole lives in some ways. All the attention is triangulated through the other child and all the energy and all the anxiety. And I always wonder what that would be like, especially in the case in this book where the younger brother, Drew, is not an athlete and is really kind of a bookish, brainy kid. And what do you do when you're sort of the odd one out in a family like that?
And this is a family that's been transformed by a tragedy. I don't want to do any spoilers, but I think it's kind of important to know about the injury to their daughter when she was a little girl.
Yeah, and it's very early in the book, but she's as a young girl, she's injury to her foot, a classic home injury, and it's one of the reasons that she's propelled into gymnastics. Her parents feel so guilty about the accident that they think that this will help her. And it came from, actually, I'd read about the Olympics figure skater Elaine Ziak, who you may remember from the 80s, and that had happened to her, and that's how she got into skating. And I thought that was so interesting about how this sort of family's way of dealing with this trauma that leads to this sort of, you know, two decades long, fascination and sort of, the challenges of this sort of sport that would never have occurred were it not for that childhood tragedy.
Megan Abbott joins us. Her new novel is You Will Know Me, and it's kind of an ominous title, particularly when we finally figure out at the end what it's all about, but you take us on quite a ride We never know where we're going. This is a family that is so determined to sacrifice everything, to go into massive debt, to spend many, many hours investing in the gymnastics career of their daughter. And then they're surrounded by these other families that are trying to do the same thing, but they can't aspire to be as wonderful as this particular daughter because she's the cream of the crop, isn't she?
Right, exactly. And I was always interested in those sort of ecosystems, you know, where when you're sort of extreme into anything like a sports or music or something like that, and you're surrounded only by other parents and children who are also invested in it, they start to, you know, it starts to become this hothouse. And I think I wanted to have that play out in the book where there's always all this attention on the child that's the best and what the parents might have done to sort of facilitate that and how they can maybe do it too so they can achieve the same result. You know, we're such a competitive culture, and I think more so maybe in the last 20 or 30 years than ever, because parents are so encouraged to be so invested in their children in a way they never were before. So it feels like a really fraught situation.
I was fascinated with Devon, the daughter, because it's almost like she's wearing armor. Throughout the book, until the very end, we don't really feel like we can see who she really is. She protects herself from everything, doesn't she?
She does, and that was one of the reasons I kept us out of her head, so that, you know, it's a close third person, which is the mother's point of view, and so we only see what she really sees or understand what she understands, and that seemed important because in some ways, the sort of prodigy or the possible prodigy is sort of enigmatic to the rest of us. But I think it's particularly interesting. You know, all parents go through that moment where they understand every gesture that their child makes. They know every facial expression. They know what it means, you know. And then all of a sudden that changes and they don't know. And I think in the case of Devon, who has to be so strong because, you know, all the weight of her family and this entire gym is on her shoulders, that strength is sort of skills essential. So I think in some ways she has to wear this mask. And whenever I see even the Olympic gymnasts who I'm sure, you know, all have, you know, great and supportive families and, you know, are probably, you know, quite different, but they do kind of wear a mask, whether it's the smiling mask or the serious mask, but we don't really know what's going on behind that.
I suppose I should mention that this is a murder mystery, and I read a lot of these, and I had to think as I was reading it, Megan's really trying to do something different here. Well, give us your thoughts on what you were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I guess I generally, you know, I've always written crime novels, and I love crime novels, but I've never really done like the whodunit sort of puzzle story. Has never been my sort of area. I always sort of more interested in character and psychology. And sort of trying to create a book where there's a real intimacy with the reader and that the book would feel like this whisper in the ear. So in some ways, Katie, the mother, is sort of letting us into the world, and we're seeing it through her eyes. And so that was always a little bit more important. You know, I certainly want to satisfy in terms of the plot, and the, you know, clues and all of that, but that's not really the reason I write the book. I really write the book as a way to explore these family issues and these ideas about parenting and you know, the sort of strength and darkness of all families.
You're out there in Southern California, and I know it's been 100 years, but I'm wondering, can you still feel the Raymond Chandler vibe out there?
I always do, because that was my first love in crime fiction and in, you know, in the film adaptations, even when I was even younger, of Chandler, you know, The Big Sleep and Murder, My Sweet. And to me, his sort of, you know, this sort of spirit of him lurks over the whole place and gives it this sort of sordid glamour that I kind of love. So I think, you know, L.A. is always changing. I always feel like the most modern of all cities. But I think so many of us first experienced L.A. and Hollywood through the lens of these movies. So I think that's always there for a lot of us. You know, as soon as you see Sunset Boulevard or Mulholland Drive, the sign, you're thinking about movies.
You're thinking about Double Indemnity, aren't you?
Yes, that's another one of my big favorites.
Oh, Fred McMurray is so good in that.
He is, and Barbara Stanwyck is great in everything, and and she's, you know, that's another great, you know, sort of femme fatale, but she sort of wears a mask, you know, you can't really get inside her, and sort of classic noir is always so close to the you know, the main character, and so everyone else always seems, you know, suspicious and mysterious, and that kind of paranoia vibe that of noir is something I've always loved and sort of has found its way into all my books.
Megan Abbott joins us. Her new novel is You Will Know Me. She joins us by telephone from Southern California. You mentioned earlier that you got a little bit of the idea for Devin's injury from something that really happened to an Olympic skater. And I know that some of your books, your previous books, have been inspired by real crimes. For example, Bury Me Deep was inspired by Winnie Ruth Judd, the trunk murderess. Now, when she arrived in Los Angeles with those trunks, was she at the main old central train station with those leaky trunks? Is that where that happened?
Yes. And that's where they sort of first got flagged, and then, you know, escaped from the train station into a department store and hid out for days. It's sort of a great LA story, but the crimes themselves occurred in Arizona. I was always fascinated by that notion, which is so noir, of her on that long train ride with these really sort of gruesome trunks and arriving in Los Angeles and then sort of, you know, going on this sort of mad flee from the authorities who you know, had the trunks but no longer had her.
I find that so fascinating to think about that, because that train station is still there. I remember, I think it was 2008, the last time they had Book Expo in Los Angeles. Did you happen to go to that one?
No, I didn't go to that one, but I know that the station is still, it's sort of in pure Art Deco, you know, glory still.
Well, that year, I was at Book Expo at the Staples Center, and they were having a party at this little restaurant at the train station. It was a party for Michael Connelly's birthday, and I caught a ride with Bob Craze from Book Expo to go to the party, and there were all these L.A. crime writers milling about, and then quite a few from New York, like Otto Penzler was there, a lot of people like that.
Oh, yes.
And it was so spooky to be at that train station with all these crime novelists and think that's where Winnie Ruth Judd had the trunks leaking blood.
Yeah, you know, I think of that when I'm in L.A. A lot of places, like the Biltmore Hotel, which is sort of one of the famous old L.A. Hotels, and it's the last place that the Black Dahlia was seen, you know, if you're a James Ellroy fan. He was really big for me, and I can never go anywhere near there without thinking of that she was last seen walking through the lobby and walking down the street. And when I remember the first time I visited L.A. years ago, staying there and really just sort of feeling the presence. You know, L.A. has always been a kind of haunted city to me.
I am a James Ellroy fan. I met him at Book Expo in New York one year. What an odd man.
He's larger than life in every way.
Wasn't his mother murdered?
Yes, he wrote an incredible memoir about it, My Dark Places, which is really, it's one of those books I've read several times, actually, because it's sort of, you know, a lot of crime writers, you know, just are like me, where we're originally inspired by books. But in his case, he had a rather tormented past, and you can see how that plays out in his book, which makes a fascinating memoir.
You also had a novel called The Song Is You, which I think was inspired by the disappearance of Jean Spangler. That case is still open, isn't it?
It is, and I guess at this point it probably will never be solved, but it was a sort of Dahlia-like case, and she was last seen in Griffith Park, and her purse was found there, and so whenever I'm back in that area, of course, I always think of Jean Spangler, and there was just an era, late 40s Los Angeles, where there was a lot of, I'm not the first person to say this, but there was a lot of sort of gender anxieties, and the men all coming back from war, mm-hmm. and a lot of sort of discomfort with what women had been taking their jobs and possibly, you know, getting into other relationships and betraying them. And so that's one of the explanations for why film noir began and why the femme fatale exists, is because there was so much male anxiety when they returned about what, you know, that their place had been usurped. And so woman is the dangerous force.
Well, I've always been intrigued by the fact that Jean Spangler had that unfinished note about Kirk, and she was involved in a movie with Kirk Douglas at the time she disappeared.
Yes, yes.
Very weird.
And I remember when I was writing the book, I was trying to be careful of any legal issues. So it was one of those where you sort of realize you're touching on real life in ways that, you know, it sort of gets blurred for you often when you're writing, or at least it does for me. And then you remember that there are real people involved in this who can sue you, yes, but also sort of be hurt by it. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of aware that sometimes as a writer, you think, you know, you sort of, this is your creation at a certain point. But when you're inspired by true crime like I am, it's always good to remember that this affected people's lives in a real way. And when I wrote Bury Me Deep, I met some of the descendants when I did book tour through Arizona, and they were very nice about it. But it was good to be reminded that these are real stories for people and personal tragedies, and so should be treated with respect.
Were they relatives of the businessman that the three women were interested in?
I did meet someone who had known him, the sort of homme fatale of Bury Me Deep, and they told me this one woman knew him when he was in his 70s, and she said that he could still charm the pants off any woman she came across. So he was a dangerous fellow.
Oh, my. In case you're just tuning in, it's the Book Nook. My guest is Megan Abbott, and we're talking about her novel, You Will Know Me. Is it genetic, Megan? I understand you come from a family of writers. Does it just kind of go through the bloodline?
Well, certainly the love of books, you know, is there, and probably both. But when I was a little kid, that was our whole experience, was reading, going to the library a couple times a week, comparing stacks. We were a family of four, sort of avid readers. So I think that was really critical for me. That sort of became my fantasy world in some ways. So I certainly owe that to them. I didn't really know I was going to be a writer for a long time, but that's probably, probably blood will tell ultimately.
You just mentioned this gentleman who in his 70s could still charm all these women, and that made me think, can we talk about your murder victim and You Will Know Me? Because he sounds like he was kind of cut from the same cloth.
Yes. A sort of sweeter version, but Ryan is sort of do a spoiler-free version of it, but he's the sort of only one who doesn't really belong other than the brother in this gym world, because he's the boyfriend of the gym coach's niece, and he's very good-looking, and sort of all the gymnast moms are sort of drawn to him like a magnet, and of course the gymnasts too have crushes on him, and he was really interested in the sense of what, when someone like that, when something happens to them, when they're an outsider and really only viewed as this sort of eye candy, when something happens to them, who's going to care enough to look, you know, to sort of try to figure out what happened to them. He sort of is sort of disposable in this culture of the gym. So that was really sort of intriguing to me. I knew whatever the crime was when I started that it had to be an outsider to see how they would deal with that.
I had Lisa Lutz on the program for her novel, The Passenger.
Oh, yes. She's a good friend of mine.
Wonderful book. And we were chatting about writers that she likes, and she said, you got to read Megan Abbott.
Oh, that's so nice.
And that's what led me. I had not read your stuff, and I'm so glad I found it, and I'm so glad she recommended it, because you have such a nuanced style of writing. I can tell that every single word is something that you've thought about very, very deeply.
Well, I always, language is sort of the way I find my way into the book, and it's sort of very sort of rhythmic to me, the way I think about writing. It's the only way I can kind of, sort of the way that I find the mood. So that's the thing I spent torturing myself the most over is sort of word by word. And I, sometimes to a fault, you know, where I'll just get stuck at the same paragraph or sentence for a long time. But I guess it's sort of like trying to cast a spell on yourself writing it, and then you hope that that spell will you know, be conjured for the reader, too.
The other day, you were the featured interviewee in the New York Times book section, that delightful little section in there, which is probably really stressful to be interviewed for. But, you know, I enjoy reading it most of the time, and they asked you, who are the authors that you just absolutely have to read? And you named three in particular, and they were Kate Atkinson, Daniel Woodrell, and William Kennedy. We've had Kate on the show. We've had William Kennedy on the show. I've tried to get Daniel Woodrell. I don't think I'll ever get him, but
No. he doesn't do much press or, you know, or any of that. He's because, you know, he sort of, you know, lives off in the Ozarks and keeps kind of quiet, mm-hmm. is what I understand.
I've tried. In fact, I believe you have the same publicist.
I do, and yeah. I do know him. I can try putting the good word.
Yeah, it hasn't done any good. I've tried to get him through Sabrina, and it's never happened. But, you know, I love his stuff.
Well, I know he's got a new book coming. Maybe this will be the one.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some authors you just give up on. But William Kennedy, I never thought I would get William Kennedy because he hardly puts out any books anymore. And I was such a fan of those Albany books.
Oh, yes.
Just loved them.
They're just so exquisite. And it is an example where you do feel like she's conjured a spell. When you're reading them, you feel so transported to time and place. And just even the way he views the world and his characters. One of the things I always loved about him and tried to model is how much he loves all his characters, you know, bad or good, dark or light. And I always thought that was, you know, so important. I know there are books where that just doesn't suit the tone. They're more satirical or they're more, you know, a little harsher or they're meant to be different. But I always responded to when I could tell that the author just loved all of them. And you feel it coming through and they're looking for ambiguity and nuance and they're not taking any shortcuts.
Well, I love being able to talk to writers about their work because we always end up taking detours. And when I talked to him, William Kennedy, he went on this detour where he did some anecdotes about when he was a newspaper editor in Puerto Rico, and he got a letter from a writer who was applying for a job as a writer at this newspaper, and he didn't hire him, but they became lifelong friends, and the writer was Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh, my gosh. That's quite – I can't picture those two together.
Isn't that amazing?
That is.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, every time I go on book tour at different bookstores, I hear Hunter S. Thompson stories. I've already heard two of his stories, so he really looms large. He was actually very influential to me. I read a lot in college. A lot of the new journalists, Joan Didion was huge for me, and Hunter S. Thompson was a part of that reading. I loved the idea that, you know, as someone who liked, it was inspired by sort of news, like true crime, I always really love to read those where they're still taking real-life situations and writing them in a kind of literary or novelistic way. So and somewhere in between there, we all maybe meet.
Megan Abbott is my guest. Her new novel is You Will Know Me. We've wandered off track. Let's get back to this story. And the way that it unfolds is so surprising. We kept expecting, I think, as readers, for some detectives to come swooping in. But it doesn't happen.
No. I've always, you know, tend to I don't know what it is about me, as it says about me, but it, you know, a lot of crime writers will, you know, they're working, their main characters or one of their primary characters is the cop or the detective or the journalist, someone investigating it. And I've always tended to write about the people covering up crimes or involved in or it happens near them and they're sort of fascinated by it, sort of voyeurs to crime. And I don't know, I suppose if I were to sort of do an analysis of my own books, I would just wonder, you know, what my view of institutional justice was.
Mm-hmm.
My brother's a prosecutor, so I believe in it personally, but in my books I tend to operate more on the fringe, I think. And I'm sort of more interested in stuff that's close to home and you know, the sort of domestic, sort of when things go wrong domestically or personally or in a small community.
Your brother's a prosecutor, huh?
Yes, he's great for fact checking. I rely on him a lot. And one of the things he's really helpful with is there's just a few remote scenes in the book where police are sort of involved. And he always tells me about how, he always gives me this tells me how hard it really is for, you know, real, like how it's not like TV or in the movies, but like real cops working in areas like counties with small budgets that don't have these grand CSI machines and don't, you know, that really that the sort of old fashioned shoe leather thing is really what's counted on. And there also has to be often in cases of a hit and run or a car accident, in the case of this book, there has to be someone really pushing, because there are so many unsolved car accidents like that. So he's really good with that kind of stuff that I would never find out on my own. It takes someone who sort of sees it every day.
Well, I've often thought that someone like Alifair Burke, being a former prosecutor, had a little bit of an edge over the rest of the writing field.
Definitely, definitely. I think that's really true, and I think that's why, or someone like Laura Lippman, who is a journalist, mm-hmm. you know, they know how messy all this stuff is in real life. They're not, you know, writing in a vacuum or you know, sort of that sort of, you know, CSI syndrome as whenever I've talked to forensic people, they call it, you know,
uh-huh.
Or even my brother will talk about how now every jury expects to see DNA evidence to prove things, and it just doesn't work that way in real life. And it's very hard to convince a jury of that because they see it on TV every night.
Well, we've had Laura on the program, and I've always wanted to interview her husband, but I don't think I'll ever get him.
Oh, yeah, you know, Lisa Lutz and I are working for him right now.
Really?
On his new TV show, yeah.
Tell us about that. We've got just enough time to hear about that.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, so it's set in 1970s Times Square. It's going to be on HBO next year, and it's called The Deuce, D-E-U-C-E. And it's David Simon, George Pelicanos, and Richard Price. So all, you know, sort of crime writer trifecta, and Lisa Lutz. And myself, and it's about the sort of nitty, like the real sort of gritty Times Square of the 70s and the rise of pornography, and then eventually we'll end up in the 80s Times Square when it sort of becomes Disneyfied and sort of paved over. So it's been incredible. We've been working on it for I guess about 6 months now, and so really excited about it.
Wow. Well, I've had George on the program a number of times, and I had Richard Price on last year, which was another one I crossed off my list. As you can probably tell, I'm kind of crazy about these books.
Yeah, well, this is, I feel like you're circling in on the Mr. Simon, so I think maybe when the show comes on, you could have a, you know, a good hook.
Well, Megan, it's really been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been delightful. Clearly, we have many reading teachers in common, so this feels faded somehow.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Megan Abbott, and her new novel is You Will Know Me. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you so much.